This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, December 20th. We'll be discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current and William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent, speaking with CAI's Gilda Geist. And we'll check in with Colin Hogan of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Plans are afoot to reimagine the use of land at Joint Base Cape Cod. Massachusetts owns most of the base, and the state's quasi-public development agency is working on a master plan that could include housing, not just for members of the military, but also for civilians. And another big story this week, some news CAI broke yesterday about one of the Cape's largest farm properties. Reporter Jeanette Barnes is here with those stories. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Let's talk about the military base. What part of the base does this master plan cover, and what's the purpose of it?
Well, this master plan is being commissioned by Mass Development, and it will cover 7,000 acres at the southern end of the base. That is the area where all of the development is right now. If listeners have heard the term the cantonment area, that is the military term for that part of the base. And the idea behind the master plan is to look at the base holistically, review how the land is being used, also support some efforts already underway on the base to make the best use of the property, and then to see if there is any surplus property there. A finding of surplus property does seem likely to happen, considering how much effort the state is putting into this. And Mass Development is saying explicitly that in that case, if there were surplus land, they would consider redeveloping it for housing or for economic development purposes.
I think this has gotten a lot of people sort of sitting up and taking notice here. The public housing would be not just for military housing. This would be for the general community.
Yeah, that's right. It's not clear yet exactly what kind of housing it would be, but certainly part of the intent is to help alleviate the need for housing in general. And that is kind of the attention getter here. But some of the people who really need housing in our area are, in fact, military. And so that would be part of it. I talked with Mark Forrest, who's one of the Barnstable County commissioners, and he said that in our region, in particular, some Coast Guard operations have been scaled back because of the lack of housing.
How about the economic development part of this? What does it mean when they say that economic development could happen on surplus land at the base as well?
That is a good question, because, of course, that is a very broad term. I asked Eric Hokinson, who's a vice president at Mass Development, whether this could mean that, say, stores would be there to go with the housing, like in a mixed-use development. And he said that is certainly possible. But there's more to it than that as well. For one thing, Barnstable County is interested in expanding the alternative septic system test center, which is already on the base. And Mark Forrest from the county commission said he hopes to also expand some work that's happening on the base now with the military on environmental technologies, things like groundwater cleanup. And he said in the future, the base could also be a place for perhaps exploring connections between the marine technology that we already have here on the Cape and in Woods Hole, and the connections between that and national defense there on the base. And I want to mention one selling point people seem to support here for doing this kind of thing on the southern part of the base is that it is a disturbed area in environmental terms. In other words, it's already been developed, so it's not, you know, sort of mowing down a pristine area.
These are just ideas now. What comes up next for this master planning process?
Well, Mass Development has issued a request for proposals to hire a consultant to work on the master plan. That is kind of the standard way these things move forward. They are expecting to hire someone in March. And then after that, they're figuring that it will probably take about 2 years to write the plan. And that, of course, involves some opportunities for public comment, for the public to make suggestions and learn about it along the way.
Okay, I want to move on to another story that also touches on land use. This is about a property in Sandwich known as Windstar Farm. It's changing hands, and what happens there could be quite different from what's happened in the past. First, tell us about the farm itself.
Sure. So this farm is about 238 acres. That was one of the numbers given to me, although the number that I saw in the town assessors is slightly different, but it's well over 200 acres.
Big.
Yes, yes. It is toward the southern end of Sandwich and actually backs right up against the runway area at Joint Base Cape Cod. I've heard that many years ago, or some period of years ago, it was actively farming as Windstar Farm. But the town manager there in Sandwich, Bud Dunham, says that he's been here since the late 80s, and he does not remember it really being actively farmed at any point since he's been here. So it's been a while. And then there was a period a few years ago when it was renamed Gopal Farm Cape Cod, which was an effort to partner with a farm in New York called Gopal Farm and share some products. But that part is apparently over now because this farm has been sold to someone new. His name is Joseph Aruda. He is from Rainham, and also his son Brandon is involved in the purchase as well. I talked to the father this week, and he said that when he was meeting with the town officials, he has actually seen some plans, written plans for hundreds of houses on this property. But right now, the property does have an agricultural preservation restriction on it. That would be complicated and probably very costly to remove a restriction like that. And he says that that is not their plan at all. They want to keep it in agriculture.
And well, tell us a little bit more about him and about what his plans are.
Yeah, so Aruda owns a sand and gravel business in Bridgewater, and the family also owns some cranberry bogs and some other agricultural property. He said to me, you know, something like, well, that sand and gravel business kind of supports his love for these agricultural pursuits elsewhere. And he said their plan right now is to build about 50 acres of cranberry bogs at the farm. There is no bogs there now that I'm aware of. And they will also be growing some hay and some silage corn. He has cows on some of his other properties off Cape, and he will be using that hay for his own cows.
50 acres of cranberry bogs sounds like a big change to me. Is that something that requires special permitting?
Yes, probably. The town manager, Bud Dunham, told me that most likely it will need a special permit from the town and go before some of the boards in town. You know, he says he's not a zoning expert, but that's the understanding in his conversations with other people, other officials in Sandwich. And then because of the large size of this property, he says also it will probably need to get approval from the Cape Cod Commission in order to put cranberry bogs there. But he pointed out that it is not a wetland, at least it is considered upland.
How does the town feel about this? It must be feeling pretty good.
Yeah, well, the town manager said generally the town staff who've been involved in these discussions seem to think that it's a really positive thing to get an active agricultural use going on that property. As I said, it's been sort of disused for a while. There have been media reports in the past of vandalism and trash and things like that on the property. The town manager did say none of the folks at town hall are really experts about how to convert upland to a cranberry bog. But he said it seems like the Aruda family has the experience to do it the right way. He also says this buyer for the farm came recommended. Bud Dunham actually first heard that this land might be selling when he got a call from the town manager in Middleborough, and that the town manager there was saying, you should really take notice that someone with a positive track record in other communities, including Middleborough, was interested in this farm. Joseph Arruda did just recently donate both the materials and labor for some new baseball fields that went up in Middleboro. So he seems to be getting a good reception in Sandwich so far. We will have to kind of see how this unfolds and whether the community has any concerns about his plans for the farm. I did hear from someone a little bit about the issue of traffic in the area, but it appears that at least at the moment, it is not going to be a retail establishment. It's kind of the location of the farm is like at the backside of a housing subdivision or, you know, pretty thickly settled neighborhood. And I think some people might be wondering about traffic going in there, but which, you know, certainly if they're building a cranberry bog, trucks will be going in. Mm. But it doesn't look right now like it's going to be a retail business right away.
And so interesting, because it does seem like it's the opposite direction we see so much open space going in these days, which is moving toward development or towards restoration of wetlands. Here's somebody coming in saying that they're excited about farming again and building out some cranberry bogs. We'll see what happens. That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We will take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to CAI's Eve Zukoff. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Two North Atlantic right whales were spotted 50 miles southeast of Nantucket, entangled in rope and fishing gear. CAI's Eve Zukoff talked to experts about how unusual it is to sight two whales in this condition on the very same day. Eve, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us, what do we know at this point about these two whales?
Yeah, the first, I'll describe to you a 13-year-old female who they saw about, again, 50 miles off the coast of Nantucket with two lines, two ropes exiting the left side of her mouth, and then both of them are extending a half to two-thirds of the way down her body. She was seen most recently gear-free off of Long Island in July, so she's picked up the gear sometime in the last 6 months, and officials say this injury will hurt her, but probably won't kill her. She actually could even shed this gear on her own. Unlike a three-year-old male who was seen back in April in Cape Cod Bay, gear-free, he was just seen the same area as this female with a thick line that passes once across his head and then once across his back. So he's pretty well wrapped. Officials say he is likely to die from the injuries this is causing. Maybe it'll take weeks, maybe months, but experts say it doesn't look good.
And these aren't the only entangled right whales that are swimming off the East Coast, right?
Now. No, these are the only two the government is talking about, but we have better sources than that sometimes. I talked with Scott Landry from the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown, and he told me about another male that was spotted off the coast of North Carolina this week who is also likely to die from his entanglement, very serious entanglement. Scott said, and this is just a quote, he said, it's entangled in such a way that the whale can't open its mouth to feed, so its lifetime is finite now. It's whatever fat reserves it has on its body, which is kind of horrifying, kept me up the last few nights. This is also usually the point people start screaming at the radio, why can't we free these whales? What's going on? And to be clear, members of a disentanglement network that stretches from Florida to Canada are alert. They are ready to jump up and try to go free these whales wherever they pop up. But they're wild animals. They're not tracked for a number of reasons specific to their well-being. So we have to first hope that an aerial survey plane sees them, and they could be anywhere. They're highly migratory, and it's winter, so disentanglement crews need decent weather so that the waves aren't too high and rough for them to operate safely, and they need to get a call early enough in the day so that they're not working in the dark. So this all kind of circles back to the point that right whale experts make to me all the time, which is disentanglement is not the way to save these animals. Boat collisions and entanglements, they say, need to be reduced. This disentanglement scheme can't be how we save all whales.
Tomorrow's the day with the shortest daylight hours in the year.
Is that right?
I believe it.
It's not a good day to save whales.
Right. So getting out there to find these whales and having enough time then to get out and disentangle them before dark comes on, this is a really tough time of year for that. Seeing three entangled right whales in just over a week, do researchers Do they hit that big red panic button and call it an emergency, or is this somehow to be expected?
Yeah, I asked this to Landry. He phrased it this way. He called this unusual but typical. Like, the number of entanglements for this species is high enough. 85% of right whales bear the scars of entanglements at least once in their life, and many have at least two entanglements in their lives or more. So he says the more we look for whales, the more we're going to discover with entanglements in trouble. In fact, he said he's aware of at least five other North Atlantic right whales that are entangled at the moment, and there are almost certainly more that just haven't been spotted. So it's kind of a backwards way to say this, but he described it as kind of like a miraculous thing that these animals are even seen so that we know about them.
And again, there's about 370 some of these animals left in the world. Each one is, as experts tell us, each one is so important to the survival of the species.
Yeah, especially with less than 100 breeding females left in the population.
Okay, we're going to keep talking about whales here, but we're going to shift to different whales, not North Atlantic right whales. Last week, you were here on the Roundup talking about two whales that washed up dead separately between Plymouth and Wellfleet in just under a week. And that was one humpback and one minke whale. Then this past weekend, another humpback washed ashore in Brewster. We're going to talk about them collectively, but first start with this humpback found in Brewster. What can you tell us about that whale?
Yeah, so researchers with the International Fund for Animal Welfare, IFA, they're based in Yarmouth, they conducted a necropsy, this is like an animal autopsy, on this whale that washed up in Brewster. They said it's a two-year-old, 26,000-pound female. It says they said that it looks like she suffered blunt trauma to her head, meaning, I'll translate that, it looks like she was hit head-on by a boat. This is not conclusive. It usually takes about 6 weeks or more for all the lab work to come back, but that's the story of her death right now. And what's kind of tragic here is that IFA folks say that this whale, who's known to researchers as Firebolt, had survived, again, only 2 years old, at least one other boat collision and an entanglement in her life.
This week you asked experts if there could be any connection between these three dead whales. What did you hear?
Well, researchers said it's certainly overwhelming to see three whales wash up in such a short period, but they are not believed to be connected. The minke whale in Wellfleet likely died from infectious disease. The humpback that washed up in Plymouth, the results are still pending. And for Firebolt and Brewster, again, the story is a head-on collision. Like, the fact is, a lot of whales are struggling to survive. So it may just be a continuation of the existing kind of die-off that a lot of whales are going through. It's not quite the legal term, but there is an official term. That's what it means for lots of whales. And that whales are in Cape Cod Bay more than prior years, which is kind of an interesting thing. Could be that.
Federal officials maintain that there are no known links between whale deaths and ongoing offshore wind activities. And whale experts don't dispute this, but you keep an eye on social media, and there is a faction online that it feels like it's trying to feed a different narrative here.
Absolutely. It's really interesting to see how many people, and I think a lot of them are really well-meaning. We've done some reporting that kind of bears this out. A lot of well-meaning people believe that whales are dying because of offshore wind. But a lot of that misinformation kind of stems from fossil fuel interests that are anti-offshore wind. And so I talked to one whale researcher about this, and she said, you know, it's devastating to try to deal with dead whales, to understand why they're dying so that you can try to help them. But when you have people wanting to attribute them to other causes of death because it serves a political need for them, it's really heartbreaking. There are lots of reasons that whales die that are really well documented, like entanglements in fishing gear and these collisions with boats. And specifically for minkes, there's some infectious disease going on. They're responsible for most of the deaths that experts feel confident that they can attribute something to. And they say offshore wind is not on the list, but they're watching it closely. But, you know, misinformation always kind of needs to be pushed back on. So that's what I am here to say.
Hey, baby whales, it's the season of new calves, right?
It's true. We'll end this on a little bit of good
news. Did I see there was like one? Yes.
Yes. Okay. There are now 3 North Atlantic right whale mother calf pairs. This is the season for it. 3 is not good enough. Maybe it'll be up to like 20 or 30. That's the more ideal number for this population. One of the whales is called Nauset. So a little local call out here. And they are heading this way. They love to spend time in Cape Cod Bay eating our rich copepods and other little crustaceans and things like that.
That is CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Should Martha's Vineyard residents receive a subsidy to offset the cost of electricity on the island because of how close the offshore wind turbines are? Unki Sunu of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with this story. Hi, Unki.
Hi, Steve.
This is a proposal being put forward by a member of the Martha's Vineyard Commission. Tell us who put this forward and a little more about what is being proposed here.
So this came from a letter that the Martha's Vineyard Commission's executive director, Adam Turner, sent to Governor Maura Healey. And it essentially is saying, due to the fact that there are many wind turbines that are planned and are underway south of Martha's Vineyard, the island residents should have some level of compensation in because of all the environmental and visual impacts that are expected and are kind of ongoing, especially the visual aspect. So electricity subsidies are what he's proposing.
So, but he's kind of made clear in the same letter that he's still in favor of offshore wind. This isn't in opposition to offshore wind, but essentially asking for some give back. Is that right?
That's right. He is still very much in favor of pursuing alternative energy sources to fight climate change. But yeah, like you said, it is a way he thinks that the island should, you know, kind of get recognition for deal, you know, having all the turbines around kind of their oceanic backyard, and when these projects will also be powering, you know, not only probably a vast part of Massachusetts, but also places like Connecticut, Rhode Island. So, you know, kind of getting something back for having the brunt of it around there.
Now, your article in the Martha's Vineyard Times also points out that the island has gotten economic benefit from Vineyard Wind already, from agreements signed early in the process, and it's in line to see quite a bit more money from this.
Well, there is an agreement that was signed for the island by Vineyard Power on behalf of the town and all that. You know, like you said, there have been various economic benefits, such as a fund to help with getting batteries for places that the towns have deemed critical, such as the wastewater facility at the airport or senior centers. And there is a program to help residents of a certain income level to get some, you know, some savings for their energy rates. But Turner is essentially arguing that, you know, while there are economic benefits coming from this, he thinks there should be a wider application for the electricity subsidies parts. I do think it should be noted, though, that we've been told that there have also, that Vineyard Power has also signed some agreements with other projects, New England Wind 1 and 2. So there might be more funds coming our way from there.
The one of the numbers estimated here, I guess, it could collectively bring in $30 million worth of benefits to the island. So a lot potential sitting there. Can you tell us where this is right now? Where does this stand right now, this proposal that the island community should see some offset in electricity rates?
At the moment, it hasn't really advanced that far. The governor's administration, they're still reviewing Turner's letter. So it's still kind of premature to say exactly where this will go. Turner's told me he is planning to talk with some of the other representatives in our region, such as Julian Sear and Thomas Oakley. So it sounds like he's gunning for it, but he's a little unsure how successful it might be.
Okay, I want to point to another story in the paper this week. Tisbury's town administrator is facing an ethics complaint from a disgruntled employee. This is coming just a few days before he leaves the job that he's held for more than a decade. It's kind of a complicated story, but just explain a little of what we know about what's going on here.
So the gist of it is that there has been a nexus complaint, and the gist of that one is that a source has told us that the allegation is that the town administrator kind of hastened the process for a project, 123 Beach Road in Tisbury, even though he was told that there should be a special permit for it. And part of the conflict of interest allegation is that the company that did like site planning and all that jazz for that property, among some others in the town, is the company that he is going to go to after he retires as the town administrator, Cerati Engineering Group. So, like I said, there's a variety of moving parts. There are still some answers that have not been completely answered. But so far, the select board of Tisbury is standing by Jay Grandy, the town administrator.
You can find out more about it at the MarthasVineyardTimes.com website. Unki Sanu, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Monomoy Middle School is continuing to deal with water leaks, which some fear may have compromised the indoor air quality at the school. The school's been working to address each situation as it arises. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here with the story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
From the descriptions in the article, it seems like the school building is beset by water leaks in several different ways.
Yes, indeed. The siding on much of the school is in pretty poor condition, and there's been a plan to replace it. But in recent weeks, it's come to light that there's been a lot of leaks, both through the siding, via windows. There was a question about whether the siding was properly installed back in '97 when the school was renovated, and that intrusion has caused some not only inconvenience but questions about the indoor air quality of the in the school. There have been a few teachers who've submitted medical reports noting that they had mold allergy problems with some of the in some of the classrooms. The school department called in a contractor to inspect the facility for mold, and they did find mold inside, but it was, according to Superintendent Scott Carpenter, it was less than the mold that you would find in the atmosphere outside of the school in general. So they're you know and they're taking these questions seriously. They've put in air filters and air ionization machines, replaced carpeting in a wing of the building to try to minimize these issues. There was a window in the library had some leakage a couple of weeks ago, and it resulted in some books getting wet and they became moldy. Those books eventually had to be discarded, and the library actually had to be closed for a week while the cleanup and repairs could be done.
This is the same school that has the issues with the siding and water getting behind the siding that it's been compromised. I think we talked about this before, and it has these roof issues ongoing.
It's all sort of part of one particular problem with this school. The siding, which if you go to our website, you can see some photos of how they tried to seal it up a bit in certain places. But you can see if you go to the school, it's pretty evident that the siding needs to be replaced, and the roof also has gone to its life. Right now, the cost of the siding replacement is looking to be about close to $6.5 million, and that's going to go to the Monomoy District Towns Chatham and Harwich at town meeting in May to approve borrowing to fund that. And the town is right now waiting for confirmation from the state that it'll cover 37%, I think, of the cost of the roof replacement, which will probably also be coming up at town meeting this spring. Unfortunately, the siding isn't eligible for state reimbursement or state subsidies from the school building authority. Luckily, the roof is, however, so at least there'll be some assistance in that. But the other than the envelope of the building having some compromising issues, the administration says the school's in good condition, and it's with a new roof and new siding, they're hoping it'll last at least another 30 to, or more years before they have to sink any major funding into it again.
Tim, you have a follow-up to a story that we first talked about in the summer of 2023. This has to do with two teens charged in an alleged racially motivated drowning attempt. One of the teens charged in this has changed his plea to guilty. Bring us up to date here.
Sure. As you said, Steve, back in July 2023, three teens were down at Goose Pond Landing in Chatham. Two of them, who are white, began to taunt the other teen, who is black, and they ended up, a number of things are alleged to have occurred, including trying to pull the black teen underwater. And this resulted in charges being filed against the two other teens, including attempted murder charges. One of the teens is being charged as a youth, and so his proceedings are closed. But one of the teens, who was a bit older, is 15, was charged as a youth offender. So his proceedings were open to the public. And just last week, he changed his plea from not guilty to guilty. And that's going to result in what's expected to be some sentencing coming up at the end of January. Right now it looks like the plea deal involves the teen getting a 3-year suspended sentence and community service, as well as having to write a letter of apology to the alleged victim and undergo some educational programming. So it looks like this situation is wrapping up. If you remember, Steve, this caused quite a controversy back then because of the racial overtones, obviously. People are interested in how this is going to work out. And it looks like everybody involved, including the victim and his family, are satisfied with the outcome of this at this point.
It's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
You are listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We are going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. The Steamship Authority has a new freight ferry running to the islands. It's the first of three sister ships, all of them used boats, purchased by the ferry line to come into service. Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current has the story of the new ship and the captain who brought it into port. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
The ship has been named the Barnstable, and it made a long journey up the coast from a shipyard in Alabama. Is that right?
Yes, that's where the MV Barnstable has been for the past year, getting retrofitted at the Alabama Shipyard in Mobile, Alabama. And as you mentioned at the top there, this is one of three new freight boats that are coming into service that the steamship acquired to replace its aging fleet of freight boats. So the boat line recently sold the MV Gay Head, and the Barnstable is going to be coming online in January and made its first trip after a commissioning ceremony in Hyannis, made its first trip to Nantucket on Monday, had a little open house for island residents to get their first look, kind of tour the boat, meet the crew, and sort of get acquainted with the new vessel.
And you stepped aboard. What were some of your impressions?
I did. It was, it's not every day. It is, quote unquote, what some people said here, just a freight boat. But not every day we get a new boat coming into service. This, compared to the other freight boats that have been servicing Nantucket, larger. The deck is will allow more cars, more trucks. Inside has a nice sort of retrofitted space for passengers. Not a huge area. And from talking to the captain who took it up from Alabama and took it over to Nantucket, more powerful, better maneuverability. And he was especially happy they have a head in the wheelhouse for the crew coming over. So he was especially excited about that. But it was an interesting day to get a look at the new boat and how it was retrofitted from its former days as a offshore supply vessel in the oil and gas industry in the Gulf.
You say that it's bigger than the previous freight boats, but it was actually cut and made shorter at the shipyard in Alabama. They took out a section in the middle of this as they're taking out from the other sister ships. Is that right?
That's right. They basically cut the thing in half and bisected it and brought it down to 245 feet in length. So that is to be in compliance with the Steamship Authority's agreement with the Hyannis with regards to the size of the vessels that can be operating in Hyannis Port that the steamship runs, but still will be in a sort of enlargement over what the steamship had before in terms of the number of vehicles and trucks that it can fit on that deck on the way over.
Tell us just a little bit about the captain who went down there. These, you know, the steamship captains, they're going back and forth from the Cape to the islands. That's kind of the route. This is Captain Jim Corbett. He got to go down and essentially, you know, he and his crew drive this up from Alabama, which means, you know, it's a long journey around the East Coast.
Yeah, it was really great to meet Captain Corbett. You know, we travel the ferries all the time on Nantucket, but typically you don't get to meet the captain. You don't get to see him or her on the boat. So it was nice to get to meet him. And, you know, as I was talking to him, you know, he talked about, you know, I said, you brought it over here. You've been training on it. And he said, well, I actually brought it up from Alabama. So I didn't realize that I was him. And he talked about the trip. It was over 14 days going from Alabama around the Florida Keys and up the East Coast. They made a couple stops, ran into some weather, but he said the boat performed really well. He's happy with the maneuverability, the visibility of it. And Jim has been a captain with the steamship since 1979, since before I was born. So it was really, really, really nice to hear his perspective on the boat and kind of recognize him for bringing it up for the steamship and for the residents of Nantucket.
Hey, also this week, an excavator was performing restoration work on the windswept bog. That's a cranberry bog that's being restored to wetlands. When something very unexpected happened, describe what happened. You've got amazing photographs of this.
Yeah, so this, if you're familiar with Nantucket and the cranberry bogs out here, one of them is currently being restored to a wetland habitat by the Nantucket Conservation Foundation, the windswept cranberry bog. So there's a lot of construction equipment in there happening now, a lot of activity. And this, we noticed over the weekend that a large caterpillar excavator had become sort of not just stuck, but basically almost submerged in this former cranberry bog. So it was pretty well in there. Obviously, they could not get this thing out, and it was in there for a couple of days. And sort of we've been talking with the Conservation Foundation about how they planned to get it out. So their contractor actually, you know, had to hire a crane company from Hyannis that came over yesterday and managed to pull this thing out and did get it out. Said there was no sort of environmental issues surrounding it. But it was quite a sight to see. So go on to our website, Nantucketcurrent.com, and check out those photos.
Oh, it makes me sweat to see the pictures of this giant machine, you know, buried halfway up, easily, maybe even more, in this muck. You can't imagine how.
It was quite a sight to see. So it was. We had to get some pictures.
Okay, Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
With the $2 million grant from the Massachusetts Tech Collaborative, fishermen and scientists on Cape Cod are teaming up to collect more ocean data than ever before. CAI's Gilda Geist spoke with William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent to learn more about this project, which is through the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance in Chatham. Here's their conversation.
Just to start, what is the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance?
So the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance is a nonprofit. It's been around for about 30 years, and it was built around the idea of the need to advocate for small boat fishermen on Cape Cod. It was formed by fishermen mostly, and it since then has expanded to serve as a place for fishermen to collaborate with public policy officials and scientists and elected officials. The whole idea is to make sure that these small boat fishermen have a voice on Cape Cod.
And so the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance recently received this $2 million grant from the Massachusetts Tech Collaborative. And so what will that grant be used for?
So this grant is being used to create a vast network of sensors. And these sensors are going to be attached to fishing gear on 150 fishing boats on Cape Cod. The idea is to establish a network and that all of this data would be fed back in real time to scientists and to the fishing boats themselves. This is an expansion of a previously created program called eMolt that's been going on in smaller forms since the 2000s. But up until recently, the number of boats that were participating in the program on the Outer Cape, for instance, was only about 12. And now there's plans to be 50 boats on the Outer Cape alone. It'll be 150 across Cape Cod. So it'll be a massively expanded program.
What kind of data will these fishing boats be gathering, and how will scientists be able to use that data for ocean science?
So the data that they're collecting, temperature, dissolved oxygen, salinity, these are all very fundamental oceanographic pieces of data. And the value of this is that we have a really hard time studying the ocean below the surface. You can get surface temperatures from satellites, but as soon as you go below the surface, we have no idea. You have to send out boats to individually take measurements of those temperatures. This is a really costly and time-intensive process for scientists to do. But fishermen, every single day that they're fishing, they are lowering gear into the water and taking it back out. If you can just attach a sensor to it, that will record it all on the way. What this allows scientists to do is identify changes in the way that the ocean is operating. For instance, in summer 2023, there was infamously a big hypoxia bubble that formed just south of Provincetown, which was a whole area of low dissolved oxygen that killed large numbers of lobsters. It was hard for that bubble to be detected. In fact, it was detected when fishermen pulled up traps full of dead lobsters. If we had a system that is like this one that's being created, in which you have a constantly updating network of sensors around these fertile fishing grounds, you would know when a hypoxic bubble forms almost instantly. In fact, Owen Nichols from the Center for Coastal Studies, he told me that if the system sort of gets up and running to the point they hope it will be, you could detect a bubble like that and then send out an oceanographic boat to take even more precise measurements immediately, which would never have been possible before.
What's in it for the fishermen?
So I spoke to a few fishermen who are participating in the program. And first of all, they get a stipend to participate. But on a grander level, they have access to the data themselves. And since some of the fisheries species that they're going for, like lobsters, they have very specific temperature requirements. And if you stuck a trap down in the water and then saw that it was significantly warmer than expected, that would allow you to make decisions based on the conditions that you're trying to seek out. For most of the fishermen that I spoke to, interestingly, they weren't too into it for just data. They said that they have a lot of ways of understanding the way the ocean works. So this new source of data will only impact them so much. They're much more interested in it because it's a way of contributing to science. It's a way of getting an extremely precise picture of the way the ocean works in the areas they operate in. And these can play a really big role in management decisions. I spoke to one fisherman who said he's really interested in this program because it'll allow them to advocate to people who are making management decisions for the ocean that they fish in. With this super precise data, they don't have to rely on broad scale averages or one-off studies. They have a constant and well-developed picture of the ocean that they themselves fish in.
That's William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent. William, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gilda.
And that is CAI's Gilda Geist speaking with reporter William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent. This is the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. Is New Bedford paying health insurance for workers who died? That's the headline on a news story by Colin Hogan of the New Bedford Light. And not to spoil the fun, but the answer is almost certainly yes. Colin joins us now. Hi, Colin.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Sounds like both the city and its public school district are taking a closer look at the lists of employees for whom they're paying health insurance. What are some of the ways this could come about, that they're paying benefits for people who shouldn't be receiving them?
Well, there's lots of different ways that this could end up happening. I was told that when someone resigns or changes jobs or becomes eligible for Medicare, so their benefits packet ought to change, or yes, even if former employees who are receiving some partial benefits in retirement do pass away and the schools or city aren't aware of it, those are all reasons that health insurance could be continued to pay for people who don't need it at all or don't need the current rates that they're getting. And both the city and schools in New Bedford are looking into this because they've become aware that this is likely happening at some level within the city of New Bedford. And they're undertaking an internal audit. The city begun its own audit. It started looking into the schools, and it said it's already found cases where it's paying for inaccurate amounts of health insurance. But how many people it's been affecting and how much cost it will bring to the city, that is not yet determined. And they said they'll only be able to provide the specifics once the audit is complete.
So this, did the city undertake the audit first and the public schools? It sounds like they're almost checking the homework of the city. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The city let me know that it was the one that initiated the audit, and the school department, which is underneath the city in some ways but operates on its own budget, decided that they wanted to make sure that whatever amount they were going to be figuring out, perhaps responsible for, though that's not clear, that they wanted those numbers to be as accurate as possible. So they've decided to run the numbers themselves. So both the city and the school department look like they'll be doing their own audits to make sure the numbers are as accurate as possible. And the audit process is now going to be updated. So the schools will be doing this every month to make sure that in the future, whenever someone resigns, retires, passes away, that this will be a problem they don't run into again in the future.
The insurance company here that the city uses is Blue Cross Blue Shield. Is that right?
That's what I heard in the meeting as they were talking about it, and it's likely the district thinks that if they do find these cases of overpayment, that they'll be able to get some reimbursement from the insurance company, but that is to be determined.
Give us a sense of the costs that we're talking about overall here. How much is the city paying for health insurance in a year?
Well, I can tell you within the school department's budget alone, which is the biggest employment center inside of the city budget. But the school's 2,000 employees, it takes about $31 million per school year to fund the health insurance benefits for all 2,000 of those employees. That's actually been a rising cost center within the school district, and they've been looking at that overall number just to track it. And perhaps as a result of taking a closer look at that number and tracking it, that might be where this has come from, this realization of maybe overpayment. But $31 million for just the school department alone. And, you know, it's really not clear what percentage of that this overpayment went to. In our research, we found that another example of something similar happened in Chicopee in 2023. And when they found overpayment on their rolls, it was about 1% of their budget. So that might be a ballpark where, you know, 1% of $31 million is about, you know, $300,000. But it's really not clear if that's going to be the same ballpark in New Bedford or if it could be even more.
$31 million a year for health insurance for the employees. That's a big number. You can understand why they're looking to try to understand, to make sure that they're paying only for people who need those benefits. What happens now? Explain a little bit more about the process of how they're going to be trying to clear up these lists.
Yeah, so the two audits are going to require that are going on both from the city and the schools. They'll be going through their employment records and also their insurance records. They'll be doing this across a couple different departments, so it's just time to go through these lists. A school district employee told me that they expect to have this done before the January school committee meeting, so within another month that this work could be done, and they'll have identified all and updated the accuracy of all records for health insurance. So as that report becomes finalized and presented to school committee members, the numbers and the cost that and how long this has been happening in the city, all questions we've posed and haven't been able to get the answer, those questions will hopefully be answered.
And is there a specific person who's set to provide oversight on this going forward then?
Yeah, inside of the city, again, because there's two audits, there's always two answers to these questions. Within the city of New Bedford, the personnel office is overseeing this, so the city has a personnel director. And within the school district, there's the head of human resources, which inside the New Bedford Public Schools they call human capital services. And inside the district, I spoke with Heather Emsley, who is that person, and she is overseeing this now for the first time. The monthly audit process, that's now the new normal, isn't something they did before. And she was telling me that in addition to this report going back, this will now be something she oversees going forward.
It's Colin Hogan of the New Bedford Light. Colin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We spoke with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent spoke with CAI's Gilda Geist. And we talked to Colin Hogan there from the New Bedford Light. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. Imagine turning over a bucket of Legos each week and saying, let's build something really great. That's how the News Roundup goes together, and it couldn't happen without the brick-by-brick handiwork of nationally recognized Lego master. It's true, Dan Treidel. You make sure every block in the News Roundup is clicked tightly into place. Thanks, Dan. Next week, we've got our very special year-end News Roundup. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker.